146 days of the ongoing U.S.-Israel genocide in Gaza. A fresh Israeli massacre kills more than 100 Palestinians and injures hundreds of others. Palestinian resistance fighters inflict more losses on invading Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. Also in the headlines, Iran successfully launches yet another domestically built research satellite into space. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The scenes of horrific killing of Palestinians have become common ever since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. The regime forces have massacred scores more Gazans who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 104 people were killed after Israeli snipers shot directly at a crowd waiting for aid in the early morning. Hundreds more sustained injuries. The dead and wounded have been taken to Al-Shifa and Kamal Awan hospitals. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned the attack, saying that it was a cold-blooded massacre. Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have also censured the massacre of Gazans. Palestinians are already struggling with shortages of food, as the Israeli regime is using starvation as a weapon against them. Shortages have caused a surge in malnutrition among children, with the UN warning of a looming famine. The Israeli genocide has so far killed over 30,100 Gazans. The U.S.-managed Israeli genocidal war continues to take innocent lives and to leave a trail of destruction in the Gaza Strip. Israel's bombing and shelling campaign since October the 7th has turned a large part of Gaza into rubble. A spokesman for the Gaza Health Ministry gives details about the catastrophic situation in the besieged territory.
The estimated casualties of the Israeli aggression stand at approximately 30,000 martyrs and over 70,500 injuries. This points to a systematic policy by the Israeli occupation of committing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Furthermore, this aligns with reports indicating the disappearance of 10,000 individuals. 70% of these martyrs are children and women, in addition to nearly 10% of the martyrs being elderly. Therefore, the Israeli occupation is carrying out a clear process of executing families. There are thousands of families that have been completely annihilated.
They are 30,000 martyrs. I don't know what the Israelis want from us and why they killed this number. It is a genocide of the Palestinian people. This is what I see, a genocide. Who bombs a tower on civilian residents, including women and children?
We've never witnessed such a number before. I'm 52 years old and I've lived through many wars, including the 82 war, which we heard about when we were young, as well as the first and second intifadas. The number of 30,000 martyrs has never been reached in such a short period, 4 months, 5 months. The intifada lasted for years, yet this number wasn't reached, nor was the number of injuries. The goal here is killing, not just displacement, but murder and extermination.
This has become a genocide unlike anything we've ever seen. Everyone is suffering inside these tents. We're dying slowly in addition to high cost of living and the people enduring pain. We are suffering greatly. We have been displaced about 100 times.
Israel's relentless bombings of the Gaza Strip and the obstacle to aid delivery have left Palestinians without food and other essentials. The UN has also warned that a quarter of Gaza's population is just one step away from famine. The lack of food has forced a displaced family to eat cactus leaves in order to survive. Let's take a listen to their harrowing narratives.
Today we are living in famine. We have exhausted everything. There is nothing left to eat. We used to eat a plant called mallow. It no longer exists. There used to be carrot and that is gone. There is nothing left in the markets. So we resorted to the last option. The cactus. We eat cactus even with its thorns. We even feed the young children cactus. A little girl is eating cactus instead of milk, instead of meat, instead of eggs. Today we can still find cactus. In a week the cactus will no longer be available and we will live on nothing. We will become dead. I, in approximately 1 month, and I have a photo, have lost some 30 kilograms this month. 1 month. I have lost 30 kilograms. Why? Because there is no food. This is our food now in the northern Gaza Strip. There is nothing else. Everything is gone. There is nothing left.
There is nothing. I have newborn babies. What should I feed them? They have become anemic. They have contracted due to lack of food and nutrition. So now we are eating cactus. I also ate from it. I ate cactus. I had cactus for lunch. We thank God. There is nothing left for us to eat.
Palestinian fighters keep putting stiff resistance to Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. The military wing of the Hamas resistance movement says it has targeted a group of Israeli soldiers in Gaza City with mortars. Hassan Brigade says that it has shelled Israeli armored vehicles there. Meanwhile, fighting continued in the southern city of Khan Yunis, where the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement says that its fighters hit an Israeli Merkava tank as well as a military bulldozer. Israel has so far confirmed the killing of 243 of its troopers since the regime launched a ground invasion of Gaza in late October. Palestinian groups say that the regime is intentionally hiding the real number of casualties among its forces in order to avoid the Israeli public anger. The Lebanese resistance movement has conducted yet another operation on Israel in response to the regime's attacks along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has said that it has targeted an Israeli military position in the occupied Lebanese Sheba farms. The group has also launched another operation targeting a gathering of Israeli soldiers with missiles weapons. The operation inflicted direct losses on the Israeli forces. The Lebanese resistance movement also targeted the cities of Ilan and Haifa in the occupied territories. Meanwhile, Israel's artillery targeted the town of Nakura in southern Lebanon. The regime's drone also fell on the outskirts of the Lebanese town of Labune. Clashes between Hezbollah and Israel have been raging since October 7. That is when Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza. Iran has launched yet another homegrown satellite as the country aims to bridge the gap with other nations in the race for space dominance. Farzana Ashudian reports.
The new satellite, Pars 1, aboard Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and a research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs nearly 150 kilograms and is capable to capture images of 95% of Iranian territory.
The Pars 1 satellite is a two-way researching satellite built by the Iran Space Research Institute and has three types of applications for collecting data from the Earth's surface. The first payload of the color spectrum with an accuracy of 15 meters, the second payload with an accuracy of 150 meters for thermal imaging, and a payload with 300 meters accuracy for imaging with shortwave infrared spectra, which is used to identify plant and forestry pests.
Some Iranians gathered in the country's Space Research Institute to watch the event and express their thoughts about this launch.
We are very proud of this moment. This cooperation between the two countries shows the country's development in international interactions.
I came here today to see this proud moment, and I hope that in the future I can play an influential role in Iran's technological developments.
Pars 1 is designed and manufactured by experts and young scientists with the cooperation of knowledge-based companies. This is the second foreign launch of Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites.
The latest launch is an important step forward in the country's space program. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran is excelling in a wide range of technological developments, including in the space sector. Farzan Ashuryan, Tehran.
Obviously a major achievement for Iran. Let's bring in Mohammad Amin Ahangari. He's an expert in aerospace technology who joins us in the studios. Welcome to the program. So a major achievement for Iran. Tell us about this Pars 1, what it's all about.
Pars 1, satellite, is an important achievement. And it's different from the previous satellites launched by Iran. The most important satellite, the most important achievement is that the satellite is over 150 kilos. It was manufactured by domestic companies. And we launched it to the height of 500 kilometers. And it was done by a Russian carrier. But the satellite is fully homegrown. This is a major development because the previous satellites were smaller and they were technically known as cubic satellites. And their application was for research purposes and they were put into a lower altitude. But this satellite is heavier. And this is actually as can be considered as a major breakthrough with respect to homegrown satellites in Iran, and it's more applicable compared and applied compared to other satellites.
The weight and the looks of this particular satellite launch was very different than the ones previous to it. It seemed much heftier, larger in bulk. Tell us what differences it lied with the previous ones and the cooperation in this case that was done with Russia on it.
As I said, this recent satellite has the weight of 150 kilos, and compared to other homegrown satellites, it is much heavier. The previous satellites that were designed and manufactured in Iran, they were below 50 kilos, and they were much lighter. So the cargo they could carry, they were less capable of, with respect to the cargo they could carry. Speaking of Khayyam's satellite, even though it had the same weight, but it was not designed by Iran, it was Khayyam satellite was manufactured by Russia. It was also launched by Russia, but this satellite was manufactured by Iran and it was launched by Russia, and this is a major step forward. And with respect to the imaging capabilities of this satellite, I can tell you that it has much greater capabilities compared to the previous ones. The ones that were earlier launched by domestic companies, and it has the capability of 50-meter and 150-300-meter imaging, and it is equipped with three cameras, and also there are other subsystems that can manage telecommunication services. The other point I wanted to mention is that cooperation between Iran and Russia in the recent launch it has been quite a successful one. It opens a new chapter, and for us, for further international cooperation. In the past, we did not. So far, we did not have much interaction with other countries. So this is a major breakthrough, and we did not have a very good view towards such scientific interaction. But this launch indicated that by defining good interaction with neighboring and friendly countries, we can have new breakthroughs and enter actually international interaction.
All right, very well. Thank you very much for that, Mohammad Amin Ahangari, expert in aerospace technology here in the studios. Thank you for explaining this to us. Well, to further expand on this, our correspondent Farzana Shurian was present at Iran Space Research Institute during the satellite launch from a Russian base. She told us more about the country's achievements in this field.
Actually, this satellite is called PARS-1. It's an imaging satellite. It's a research one. It's a research measurement satellite, and which is designed and constructed, as I mentioned, by the young scientists and Iranian scientists. And this launch was announced by Iran's communication minister Zarepour yesterday, noting that this actually launch is in order to develop international interactions and to develop the international relations between the two countries, between Iran and Russia. And we know that this launch is happening despite the unilateral Western sanctions. And we know that this is not actually the first time that Iran has done such thing and has launched a satellite more than 11 times. This proud moment has happened. And last month, what I can tell about the history of these kind of activities that Iran has, last month, Iran successfully put into orbit three homegrown satellites with a minimum altitude of 450 kilometers and a maximum of 1,100 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And as I can see, people are still here and watching this proud moment, and we're all proud.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
In Britain, leading doctors have said more than a third of cancer patients in England are facing potentially deadly delays, with thousands of people forced to wait months to begin their treatment. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Research has revealed cancer patients in the United Kingdom wait up to 7 weeks longer to begin radiotherapy or chemotherapy than people in comparable countries. The stark findings are yet more damning evidence of the extent to which the United Kingdom lags behind other nations, as experts warn that people's chances of survival are being affected by long waits for treatment. In the first research of its kind, experts at University College London analysed data from more than 780,000 cancer patients diagnosed between 2012 and 2017 in four comparable countries: Australia, Canada, Norway, and the United Kingdom. Eight cancer types were included: esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, colon cancer, rectal cancer, liver cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung cancer, and ovarian cancer. The two studies, published in Lancet Oncology, were the first to examine treatment differences for eight cancer types in countries across three continents. The research found British patients experienced the longest waits for cancer treatment. The average time to start chemotherapy was 48 days in England, 57 in Northern Ireland, 58 days in Wales, and 65 days in Scotland. The shortest time was 39 days in Norway. In radiotherapy, Britain fared even worse. It took 53 days on average for treatment to begin in Northern Ireland, 63 days on average for treatment to begin in England, 79 days on average for treatment to begin in Scotland, and 81 days on average for treatment to begin in Wales. In Newfoundland, Canada, which had the best record, the average wait was 42 days. Compared with Newfoundland, waits for radiotherapy in Northern Ireland were 11 days longer. In England, it was 3 weeks longer, and in Scotland and Wales, it was 7 weeks longer. The research also found that in the United Kingdom, a lower proportion of people with cancer were given chemotherapy and radiotherapy than in other countries. 59% of ovarian cancer patients in the United Kingdom received chemotherapy, compared with 67% in Canada, 72% in Norway, and 73% in Australia. The same was true for pancreatic cancer patients, 27% in Britain, compared with 41% in Canada, 44% in Norway, and 47% in Australia. The study showed that older patients were the least likely to receive chemotherapy and radiotherapy treatment, particularly in Britain. For example, 2% of UK patients aged 85 and over received chemotherapy, compared with 8% in Australia and 14% in Ontario, Canada. Although not all patients need them, chemotherapy and radiotherapy are key treatment options. The International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership research found countries with better cancer survival rates typically made greater use of chemotherapy and radiotherapy and had shorter waits for treatment. Cancer Research UK, which part-funded the two studies, said delays to begin treatment were partly a result of the British government's lack of long-term planning on cancer in recent years. It said countries with robust cancer strategies backed by funding had seen better improvements in survival rates. The charity said the National Health Service workforce crisis was also a barrier to delivering treatment as far as cancer patients were concerned. Michelle Mitchell, its chief executive, said, "When it comes to treating cancer, timing really matters. We can learn a great deal from other countries who have stepped up and substantially improved cancer services. With a general election on the horizon, the British government has a real opportunity to buck the trend we see in this research and do better for people affected by cancer." Dr. John Butler, a cancer surgeon and clinical lead for the International Cancer Benchmarking Partnership, said, "Lower use of chemotherapy and radiotherapy in the United Kingdom could impact people's chances of survival, especially for older patients." He said cancer survival in the United Kingdom remained about 10 to 15 years behind that in other countries, adding, "This study captures missed opportunities for patients in the United Kingdom to receive life-prolonging treatment." The Department of Health and Social Care said it had invested significantly in cancer care since the period covered by the research, including £162 million on radiotherapy equipment and £2.3 billion on community diagnostic centres. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Social Care claimed, "Survival rates are also improving across almost all types of cancers." The website Press Reader has also covered the same story and tells us more. Leading doctors have said more than a third of cancer patients in England are facing potentially deadly delays, with thousands of people forced to wait months to begin their cancer treatment. According to the latest performance data for England, there has also been a significant surge in people experiencing long waits in accidents and emergency departments, though officials claim the overall National Health Service waiting list continues to fall. Doctors raise concerns that cancer targets across the National Health Service were still being missed, even when somebody has been diagnosed with the disease, with one vital target now not hit for 8 years. The proportion of patients waiting less than 62 days in December from an urgent suspected cancer referral or consultant upgrade to their first definitive treatment for cancer was 65.9%, up slightly from 65.2% in November. The target is 85% and was last met in December of 2015. The figures emerged in the same week that Britain's King, Charles III, began treatment for cancer within days of being diagnosed. Buckingham Palace has not specified whether the King is receiving private healthcare or being treated under National Health Service. While he is already receiving expert care, his treatment has drawn further attention to the long waiting times in the National Health Service. Professor Pat Price, a leading NHS oncologist and co-founder of the Catch Up with Cancer campaign, said, "Today's National Health Service data shows that more than a third of cancer patients face potentially deadly delays. In December, 7,661 cancer patients waited more than the maximum recommended 62 days to start their cancer treatment, with 2,227 waiting 3 months or more. Meanwhile, the data showed hospitals remained under pressure. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospital hit 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This is the second highest figure on record.
Hidden Files. The scientist gave no mind to security warnings that fateful day. He had to return from his vacation to teach a class the next day and wasn't going to let anyone stand in his way. After 14 years of high security, perhaps he was just ready to face his fate. Whatever it was, he hit the road, and not long afterwards, the news was blasted everywhere in the country. Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the father of Iran's nuclear science, had joined his martyred colleagues assassinated by the Israeli regime. But just who was Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and what had he done to deserve the honor of martyrdom? And why did the U.S. and Israeli regimes plan this assassination and more in hopes of dismantling Iran's nuclear program? Well, my dear colleague Mariam Azadeh is joining us with a bit of history on this topic. Mariam, please tell us more about Dr. Fakhrizadeh.
Well, thank you, Marzia, and greetings to your audience. Now, over the years, the authorities of the Islamic Republic have declared time and time again that the country's nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Iran signed the Treaty of the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons in 1970, and careful investigations and reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown the Islamic Republic's compliance with the treaty over the years. Even more reassuring than the treaty and the IAEA reports is the clear and strict stance of Islam that is the very foundation of the Islamic Republic. Even at the height of Saddam's invasion of Iran, when the Ba'athist regime in Iraq was bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons, the late leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, declared that it's forbidden for the Iranian military to respond in kind. He himself prevented the production of chemical weapons on the grounds that Islam does not permit using weapons of mass destruction aimed to inflict harm on civilians. Then there's the verdict issued by the current leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khamenei, that reaffirms that the use of WMDs using chemical weapons and nuclear weapons is strictly forbidden in Islam. And yet the U.S., with well over 5,000 nuclear warheads, and the Israeli regime, with some 400 nuclear warheads, have committed countless crimes to stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program. But it seems that these crimes have only made Iranians more determined in their pursuit of nuclear technology.
I'm very happy to welcome to Hidden Files two of the sons of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. We have Dr. Mehdi Fakhrizadeh and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. Welcome to the program. I'd like to start off with, of course, a very difficult time, the day that your father was assassinated. How did you find out about it?
In the name of the compassionate and merciful God, it was around 2:20 p.m. on November 27, 2020, when my mother called me and altered a sentence that echoed in our minds for 20 years. In that phone call, she simply said to me, "Mehdi, they've shot Dad," a three-word sentence I'd been waiting to hear every day for two decades. At the time of the call, the sounds of explosions and chaos were audible because my mother was the only one with my father. When I inquired about the location of the incident, I learned that the incident had occurred in Absard County. Immediately, we coordinated with my brothers and reached the site. When they had transported my father to Absard facility for initial treatments, we arrived and later, he was airlifted to a hospital in Tehran.
It's so difficult. I can't imagine. And your brother said you were waiting for this for 20 years. What does that mean? What is that like to be waiting to see if your father is going to be killed, become a martyr or not? What does it mean?
As my brother Mehdi mentioned, particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, life had been challenging for us. Despite my father's efforts to prevent security issues and pressures from affecting the family, the created security conditions had entangled the entire family. Nevertheless, he never abandoned his efforts to achieve his goals, which were nothing but the elevation and empowerment of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the country. The first attempt on his life dates back 20 years before his martyrdom, and during these two decades, there were four unsuccessful terrorist operations against him. In a video, Olmert speaks and says, "We wanted to assassinate Fakhrizadeh."
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
And when the reporter asks how well he knows Fakhrizadeh, he replies, "I know him well enough that if I see him in a crowded street, I can easily recognize him."
Well, what about you guys? I mean, did you ever say, "Okay, it's enough. It's too much pressure"?
No, unfortunately, no.
No, fortunately not. Anyway, a part of these tireless efforts, or as Iran's leader calls them, enduring efforts, belongs to our adolescence or a part of our childhood, which we understood to some extent. But our effort was one of our goals, and we are thankful that we were with him in understanding through mutual understanding, companionship, and solidarity.
You said pressure on you and also your children before and still.
Yes.
What kind of pressure right now? What are we talking about right now?
In two or three segments, we can define the pressure on the family. The first segment was before my father was introduced and recognized, meaning the time when he was on the hit list and attempts were made to assassinate him. Incidents had occurred, but intelligence and security services and the Zionist regime had not yet introduced him to the public. These pressures were internal and stemmed from concerns, anxieties, and potential losses. The second segment was when the intelligence services began to introduce him, meaning becoming recognized by the people. When he became known to the public, we too involuntarily became known, meaning we had to answer various questions. In many instances, we denied our relationship to inter-various fields, but in some cases, we couldn't deny it, and various kinds of damage were inflicted upon us. For example, one aspect that was not important to us, but turned out to be a positive outcome, was that many individuals in the business sector cut off their professional ties with us due to concerns that their business connections with us might lead to their sanctions. This was a part of the pressure at the time. After the martyrdom, some of the past pressures lingered, and new pressures were added. I want to mention a small emotional aspect, the loss of a prominent figure, which apart from being a prominent figure in the world and national arena, we have significant effects. We heard that during his lifetime, he was recognized by Foreign Policy magazine as one of 500 powerful figures globally. In any case, the world recognized him as someone who had accomplished significant events. This recognition of his personality also existed within the family. Nevertheless, when this powerful pillar is removed, everyone, relative to the depth of the relationship they had with him, is affected. An example is a question my youngest child, who was only 2 years and a few months old at the time of his martyrdom, still asks me, when will we become martyrs and join Grandpa? I emphasize that the discussion is not merely about his removal or exclusion from the nuclear issue. Of course, the majority of the issue was related to nuclear matters because it was a highly sensitive and a strategic matter for Iran. For Iran's enemies, a country like Iran being equipped with nuclear knowledge independently and without the need for another country with a long-standing sanctions was an unacceptable issue that they could not tolerate.
Okay, let me leave it right there because I'm going to ask a question a little bit later about that particularly.
Okay.
But you had mentioned about his personality. I want to talk a little bit about who he was as far as a father in the house, just his personality in general, hobbies. Tell me about your father.
It can be said that he had a multidimensional personality. When we look at the personal dimensions, we see he was a poet and a literary individual with a strong interest in literature and involvement in literary matters. In another dimension, when we look at his personality, we see that in the field of philosophy, he had his own opinions and thoughts. His entry into the realm of philosophy dates back to his 16 years of age when he became interested in philosophical subjects. Prominent philosophy professors acknowledged that when he came to the Sadr Philosophy Institute, he raised questions and had answers to those questions that did not even cross their minds. These subjects were not discussed in either the religious or university context, let alone providing answers to them. In the field of management, when you look at him, he managed a complex set of operations in 16 different areas. This involved working with hundreds of scientists and achieving results. One of his oldest colleagues and friends mentioned that Fakhrizadeh did nothing during his 30 years of service unless it was the first time in the country or the world.
What an amazing life that he had. With your father, you said that you had been waiting for that news for 20 years. What would he say to you all? Because obviously he knew that he was a target. What would he tell you about the possibility of him being martyred?
At various times, events occurred, and some of them we became aware of unintentionally, while others needed to be brought to our attention. So he did. Of the four or five instances of assassination attempts that happened to him, perhaps we became aware of one of them after his martyrdom, but we were involved in three or four of them during his lifetime. This was because we also had to be prepared for such events. Preparations had various aspects, and we had to be prepared for after his passing. Perhaps the paternal recommendations or last-minute advices are one of the interesting aspects of such events. Sometimes an individual may give advice once, but for us, within 20 years, we're always involved in these events, as if a person, if their death is destined to happen, experiences it once in a sickness or deathbed, but it was on the brink of such events every day. Therefore, for us, every day was a final day, and he had last-minute recommendations for us every day.
Amazing. Amazing. When did you find out about the type of projects that your father was involved in, or did you find out, did you know the importance of his work?
I have said this in several places. Just as much as my father was unknown to the people in work-related matters, he was also unknown to us. He was never in a situation to talk about projects or the work he was doing and achieving results at home. Even after 3 years, I still hear things about his work and projects that are new to me. Naturally, more than 90% of the activities carried out by Martyr Fakhrizadeh or are currently ongoing are not open for discussion because they are confidential.
Absolutely amazing life. Let me ask you, Mehdi, did you ever think maybe we shouldn't just insist on nuclear technology? For example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, we know that there have been, you've mentioned, several nuclear scientists who have been martyred. We know the Islamic Republic has advanced technologies in various fields, from nano to stem cell technologies and others. What would you say, I mean, if Iran just gave up on its peaceful nuclear program? Why not?
There are two discussions or two dimensions here. One is the discussion of nuclear energy, the discussion of nuclear technology and nuclear knowledge. We're not only talking about nuclear energy, we're talking about nuclear technology and knowledge. Today, everyone knows that it has various applications and is among the fundamental and foundational sciences. It has diverse applications and is strategic for the country. Therefore, the country must focus on the development of nuclear science, even though it has been repeatedly emphasized, mentioned, and even examined that Iran's nuclear program is a peaceful program. Unlike many other countries, where their primary use of nuclear technology is for military purposes and violates human rights, Iran has a peaceful program. Today, good information is provided that exploitation must take place in various fields, including agriculture. Iran, like other countries, cannot and should not be deprived of using this knowledge and technology to secure the interests of its people and the residents of its cities. The second issue here is that knowledge, especially cutting-edge technologies, is empowering. Empowerment has various aspects, with the most significant being independence for powerful countries. These countries strongly resist dependence and do not want other countries to become independent. They always prefer to be in need and are inclined to maintain dependencies, reaching out to other countries.
Right. Well, your father wasn't the first scientist, as I just said, to be assassinated. And it was by the American and Israeli, of course, regimes. And these assassinations were not only to slow down, to halt the progress of individual projects, but also to send a message to others not to go into that field, not to do that. Do you think that they have been effective in sending that message to others or not?
Perhaps it was the morning after his martyrdom, a Saturday morning, when I explicitly, in the first interview I had with some television networks, wholeheartedly stated the following sentence: an arrogant regime such as Israel should fear the martyred Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as much as it feared him alive. This is a reality, at least in the events after the martyrdom, where in fact when we complete the puzzle of the assassinations, we come to two points. Firstly, they are genuinely still afraid of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and now they fear him even more. Secondly, the very subtle message of the Supreme Leader regarding his actions and activities, illustrating how impactful one can be not only within the geographical boundaries of their own country, but far beyond. One could boldly say that he was not just an Iranian scientist, but one of the greatest scientists of his time in the Islamic world. This is an undeniable fact. Some of the work he did was closely tied to his personality, knowledge, and capabilities. Naturally, after his martyrdom, these tasks cannot continue, or if they do, they may continue with less power or force. In certain areas, given his high managerial abilities, his work on succession planning and establishing suitable structures or projects and other matters would not necessarily come to a complete halt with his martyrdom. We certainly hope that, following the explicit orders of the leadership, all his scientific and technical activities in all areas he was involved in will continue. I would like to mention a point related to this matter which may be relevant to your question. At the beginning of the message announced by the Supreme Leader the day after the martyrdom of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, he states, an outstanding and distinguished nuclear and defense scientist. But where he wanted to say, go and carry out his work, he did not say, go and carry out his nuclear work or go and carry out his defense work, because the Supreme Leader knew perfectly well in which areas he was capable. Where he wanted to give orders for his activities, he used the phrase go and pursue his work seriously. Let the officials follow up on all his scientific and technical work in all areas he was engaged in. We hope that following this strict order of the Supreme Leader, the work will proceed well. I have said this many times. Iran has shown that the youth within its borders are all capable and worthy. This soil has nurtured Soleimani. This soil has nurtured Fakhrizadeh. This soil will never be devoid of individuals like Fakhrizadeh, and God willing, the work will proceed smoothly.
Do you have any final comments? I mean, if we look at the overall situation of the Islamic Republic of Iran now and technology, are you optimistic about the future of Iran?
Exactly. In any case, over the past 40 years, we have demonstrated that we can open the greatest peaks of knowledge and technology in various fields from within ourselves and relying on our own capabilities. This includes nuclear technology, nanotechnology, stem cells, computer science, and today, in artificial intelligence and more. We have international documentation, scientific articles published by Iranian youth in emerging fields demonstrate that Iran is highly capable and performs well. We have witnessed significant growth and advancements, and we envision a bright future for our country. In the end, the point I want to make is that the assassination of Martyr Fakhrizadeh and those like them is a blow not only to Iran or the Islamic world, but to human society. We lost a scientist, and they assassinated a scientist who was engaged in fundamental and foundational activities in the field of science, contributing to the beneficial development of human society. These assassinations occur to achieve malicious goals that certain groups have, not for the sake of human society or even for a specific nation. I emphasize that these assassinations occur for the sake of goals that certain groups have. Hopefully, the global community will wake up to this awareness and we will witness the confrontation with such behaviors, the result of which is a violation of the human rights of different nations and a gross violation of human rights in general.
Yes, we hope so. Thank you both for being with me, Dr. Mehdi and Dr. Hamid Fakhrizadeh. I appreciate you being with me.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with more of the program. And thank you, viewers, for staying with us. Don't go away. There's more to the show. Stay tuned.
Now, some may ask, with so much pressure on Iran to stop its peaceful nuclear program, with all these sanctions and the sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of Iran scientists and more, why doesn't the Islamic Republic just give up on its nuclear program? So let's go over a few reasons. Now, one of the major uses of nuclear energy is in the production of electricity. France, for instance, gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear energy. Now, for Iran, a country with a dry climate, using nuclear energy instead of hydropower plants is ideal, and it's dedicated at least 5 nuclear power plants to the production of electricity. This technology has many uses in the agricultural industry, from genetic modification to pest control using sterilization to water usage control and much more. Now, these are just some of the reasons that the Islamic Republic insists on making use of nuclear technology like other countries, and it has the right to do so. But it's not really about nuclear energy. Over the years, many sanctions have been placed on various other types of technology in Iran as well. The main goal is to keep the Islamic Republic of Iran from progressing, a goal that has clearly failed.
Fakhrizadeh, the Iranian nuclear physicist, vaccine developer, university professor, and more, is no longer amongst us. Now he's reached his dreams of martyrdom while fulfilling what he deemed the holy mission of working to advance his country and serving his people, the dream of giving everything he had for the worthiest cause he knew. Well, today, the same criminal entity that took the life of Fakhrizadeh continues to commit a genocide in Palestine. The same entity that accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of reaching for nuclear bombs has dropped over 40,000 tons of explosives on the Gaza Strip alone, breaking the record of American nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in death and destruction. But just as the mass murder of Palestinians has not stopped their resistance against Israeli occupation, the assassination of Iranian scientists has only made Iranians more determined to advance their country through their peaceful nuclear program. Well, Iran has certainly lost a few heroes, but the Israeli regime has lost face to millions of people who are taking to the streets to denounce its crimes across the world. And it's just as Imam Khomeini, the late leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, had said, "Go ahead and murder us. It will only awaken the masses."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.